Antonio, Elon had a moment of reflection, and he was talking about 2008. He's talking about the imminent collapse, as he felt it, of SpaceX and Tesla at the same time in December 25th. And he said there were just a handful of people who came out there and put their careers on the line for him. Yourself and Steve Jurvetson specifically mentioned.
And Ira,
and it was a particularly poignant moment for him. He was getting a little choked up about it. Tell us about that bet you made in 2008 and the potentially career-ending bet for you to bet in an electric car company at that moment. Take us back to that decision.
Yeah, but before I do that, I just want to say that I left my wallet backstage because the last time I was with the four of you, I lost a lot of money. And I realized that I better leave all the cash somewhere where you can't get it. And you also made me cry. So I think I might cry again now.
Of joy?
I mean, no, it was more like humiliation.
Yeah.
But
we're playing poker.
Yeah, we're playing poker.
Wait, you pulled a Palmer Lucky?
Yeah, we're playing poker. Yeah. No, so if I cry again this time, it will be from a sense of just gratitude for those moments that we got to share. So for us in particular, because, you know, our strategy is so operational, I was there working on supply chain in the factory and on sales in that period, along with my partner, Tim Watkins, and three or four of our supply chain people. And we had a major problem in supply chain. The costs were way out of control. And, you know, Elon was doing the engineering on the very expensive parts. We were doing the B parts. And man, it was brutal. But it was very clear to us that, and remember, it was also the middle of the financial crisis, right? So we had to triage our portfolio. We had to decide, we didn't have a lot of capital at the time. These are tiny funds, $120, $300 million funds, where our capital go, where our people go, more importantly, where our operating people go, and where I would go. And we decided to focus on Tesla because, first, we really did believe in Elon when most people didn't. And we saw in him something very special, which I think you probably saw here yesterday, that not only is he a brilliant, brilliant engineer, you know, 1 in 100 year kind of engineer, he's a man of deep conviction and deep passion and deep compassion. What he is doing is really trying to bend the arc of humanity for all of us because he really cares. And that came through to us, and we wanted to be on that mission with him. And so we were privileged enough to be there in a moment in time that it mattered. And it was really hard, man. I mean, we had clients. I actually had a client said to me, "How do I know this isn't DeLorean?" And I said, "Look, I can tell you for a fact, we are not selling cocaine out of the back of the factory in the cars."
Yeah.
There's no
DeLorean
yeah.
being the famous Back to the Future
exactly.
car.
Exactly.
Where the owner was yes. trafficking cocaine to underwrite the car.
Exactly. I may live in Miami, but even Tony Grassi's, but we're not selling cocaine for sure. That I'm sure. yeah, but no, it was a career betting event for us, and it turned out right. It was the right thing to do. But yeah, for me, it was, I'm just deeply grateful for these experiences.
But I mean, you really doubled down because you didn't just do Tesla. You also were there in some really critical moments at SpaceX as well.
We were, although I tell you, you know, we doubled down at the time in Tesla. We put more money in Tesla in the middle of the financial crisis and then helped lead a convert round there that was really tough for us to do and then put money in SpaceX. But I tell you, operationally, like in terms of capital stack, I think there were other people around and SpaceX was also running out of money. And so we put money into SpaceX. Operationally, we worked at SpaceX over the years, but it was never as existential in terms of the operations as it was at Tesla. I mean, Tesla was truly, I think, truly existential. And because we were operating guys, and I myself had been a factory manager, I worked in auto parts, an auto parts factory, I'd run industrial facilities myself, we could kind of uniquely add value there. In the rocket factory, you know, we were just less valuable. But yeah, both these companies were going down at the same time, and, you know, the amount of stress we were all under was extraordinary. But, you know, looking back on it, it's one of the greatest moments of my career. I mean, this sense of fellowship, you know, I think the great thing about being in our business, the business we are all in, is that we get to back amazing people that are trying to change the world. And in these dark, 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 deep moments, we get to go to war for them. And in those moments, I call them these moments of fellowship where you just care deeply about someone and passionate about the mission and you get to make a huge difference. Like, these are the highlights of my career. And if you ask my partners, they tell you the same thing. These are the best moments. We've had some together. Three of us have had some together. Actually, we've all had some together here on the stage. We had to fight for something we believed in, and it's a privilege, man, to do it. It's a privilege to be in that situation. It's a privilege to be with Elon. It's been a privilege to be there with all of you at different moments in my career, and I'm very grateful for it.
How do you feel like you come off of a high after having huge successes like that? Like, how do you stay grounded and motivated to try to find the next one? If in the back of your mind there must be a little piece that says it's never going to be as good as this guy or those two things. Or...
I mean, you know, it's an interesting question, Jamath. I think that there's a couple things in play for us. One is we keep going because we believe in making the world better. We invest in companies that we believe make a difference with people we respect and we're values aligned with, and that's the ethos of our firm, right? So whether it's large or small, we may never find something that's as important as Tesla and SpaceX again, but we will find more great people and we will help them. You know, two of our companies here, I mean, we invested in Anduril with Palmer. We have a small investment in Flexport, which should have been one of the biggest mistakes of the last 10 years of my career is not putting more money in Flexport.
Around, yeah.
Yeah, no, we it's kind of a funny story about, we had, I'd say kind of a soft handshake on a term sheet at, say, a price of X, and SoftBank came in like 2 days later and made it 2X, and I had too much price memory to keep going and co-lead it, so it was an error. But you have two people on the stage here. They're extraordinary entrepreneurs that are trying to make the world better. Both these companies are really great and making the world much more, particularly now post-COVID and in times of war, making it much safer for all of us. There are people like that out there. There's more of them. They may not be Elon. You know, it was probably one Elon in our generation, but there's lots of great people, and I'm very optimistic about what's happening now in the economy. We're seeing incredible, incredible innovation with tremendous entrepreneurs in our pipeline. So maybe there's another one. I don't know.
Hey, Antonio, how do you think about in the businesses you guys invest in, there can sometimes be a very long capital deployment cycle before you see any real return in terms of, you know, business value, whether it's pharma. I know you've done pharma, some of these hardware companies where there's a big build cycle. How much do you need to kind of think about and see a customer and revenue show up before you're willing to say, hey, let's build the big rocket ship to go to the friggin' moon? And how do you judge and value that business and back a team?
It's a really interesting question. I think it depends on the sector we're in.
Yeah.
And it depends on how we look at the world sort of probabilistically. And we're looking for companies that we call pro and trivial, where they get better and the world gets worse. So in the case of pharma or something like SpaceX, we'll think about, like, what is our probability tree here? What's the probability of loss? Probability of 3X, a 5X, a 10X, a 100X. And then we'll think about, when the capital goes in, what is the actual return on capital? And I was watching the talk you guys had with Ryan about what happens to the public markets. The reality is that what a business is a machine. You put capital in one side, and out the other side comes return. The ROIC, the return on invested capital, really matters. And if you're kind of a classically trained investor the way I am, we think about that a lot.
Yeah.
So even though we may be putting a lot of capital in, the question is, what's the margin going to be in the back end? A company like SpaceX, a lot of capital is going in, but we know that if it works, and we believe it will work, we're ultimately going to have a company that has tremendous margins, even in the industrial sector, because of the industry structure it's in. It lives in an oligopoly inside the U.S. and outside the U.S. So it's like building Starlink, same thing, capital going in, but we know that the margins and the profitability of that business on the back end will be very, very high, and so the ROIC will be very good.
Are you backing a lot of deep tech startups? Like, companies, a founder shows up with a PowerPoint, they're like, I need $50 million to make our prototype. Happens there?
It depends on the business. So as an example, we have passed on things that are our view going to have margins that are ultimately competed to a low level.
Right.
And, you know, there are, I don't want to give examples here, but there are lots of examples of people that are doing things in, you know, I'll call it electric aircraft, VTOLs, et cetera. We look at this and say, this is going to be a highly competitive market. These are not N of one. SpaceX is an N of one. If you compare that to someone making an electric vehicle that, say, an electric airplane or electric VTOL, that will not be an N of one. It will be an N of many. And in an N of many business, you're ultimately going to have margin competition that's going to make it that return on capital goes down to basic industrial margins. You know, like, it won't be that much better than Boeing's ROIC or Airbus's ROIC, because those will be ultimate competitors.
You said it a little too, I think, superficially, so let me just double click. And I think Antonio brings up, I think, one of the most important principles of investing that is so utterly poorly understood, which is ROIC, ROIC, return on invested capital. Most people don't even know what it means, how to calculate it, NOPAT over your weighted average cost of capital. These are enormously fundamental principles when you're running a business, especially in a moment like this, because when the rubber meets the road and you need a lot of money and you run into somebody as sophisticated as him, he's already worked from first principles to understand it. It's really, really, really important to know these things, because these are the core foundations of valuation, you know? So obviously DCFs are one framework, but ROIC is incredibly, incredibly important, especially when you make real things and you need to spend CapEx.
In a world in the last 10 years where money's free, nobody thinks about this very much. We always have thought about it, which informs our investment model. But yeah, Chamath's right. I mean, in today's world, if you're an entrepreneur and you can show up and say, listen, I have a 50, 60, 70% return on capital, every dollar you give me will yield a 70, 80% return on the back end, even though we're losing money along the way, that's a very compelling case relative to, hey, we're losing a bunch of money, we're not really sure what's going to happen, which is what we hear a lot.
This also builds on the question from yesterday, which is how do you present yourself as, you know, a young emerging company and cut through all the noise? An understanding of these things and about future value creation in a moment like this becomes really important as well. Even if people will debate whether it's right, people will give you credit for the intellectual honesty of actually going there and understanding these things. Really important.
You see it a lot where companies slip away from first principles. So, you know, the first principles on a high margin enterprise software business, you can define ARR and assume some, and then people say, hey, some multiple of ARR is your valuation comp, like your, you know, your multiple. And then another company shows up and the margins are different, the growth profile is different, the revenue retention is different, it's a services business, and they try and use a similar sort of comp, and all of a sudden everyone's thinking about valuation as a function of some industry standard comp as opposed to going back to understanding how did that comp get created in the first place and what's the nature of the business from which that comp arose. And people are doing things like calling revenue ARR, you know, it's not even subscription right. revenue and so on. And I think that happens considerably more. And then that investing cycle just becomes, you know, hey, well, the next round will be this multiple. And, you know, that's how we'll get our increment in valuation. And everyone just misses the core, you know, proposition of building a valuable business that can generate.
What's your look through into the economy just from your portfolio companies?
Look, I think we're in a recession. I mean, I don't know if someone's already said this, but we're in a recession. We're in a recession. And this will be like my, I don't know, 100th cycle or something. I'm pretty old, right? Like the rest of us here. We've seen it over and over again. And, you know, I see David's tweets about go raise 2.5 years of money. This is correct. I mean, you need enough capital to get through the problem. But the good news about this recession, and, you know, there is some good news here, which is, to me, if you look at the macro picture here, it looks like, if you kind of look at the amount of federal debt, the state of the consumer, and kind of what's happening in business formation, it actually looks a little like post-World War II to me. In that in the World War II period, we had the last massive mobilization or demobilization of the American economy occurred in World War II.
Right.
That happened again in COVID. When we change, in this case, it's like a mini version of remobilization, that we're restarting the economy. We flooded the system with money to kind of buffer the problem and restart the economy. And now we have inflation, but we also have lots of business formation, and we have new ways of doing work, which is what happened after World War II. Mm. So I'm very optimistic because most of these recessions, you know, to really get inflation down, we're going to have to reduce consumer demand and or change oil prices. So for sure we should be pumping oil in this country. I know it's controversial, but that's important, to lower oil prices to get inflation down. But the reality is underneath the numbers, there's a lot of innovation happening. And that's what happened kind of post-World War II. So I would say we're in a bit of a mini retooling. It's going to be a rough year or two. Hang on, it will be a rough year or two. But the consumer's in pretty good shape. So they're not over-levered. We should come out okay. And the U.S. economy is so resilient, man. Like, you know, we are all either one generation from being immigrants or immigrants here. I think most of us, right? It's the best place in the world to live. We're the most innovative economy in the world. I'm super optimistic what's happening here because there's so much innovation, so many smart people working so hard to make things better. I think it's going to be great. I think when we get to the next couple of years, it's going to be great.
Talk about this pumping more oil situation. Obviously, Russia's involved in and we talked about it earlier today, had a debate about Ukraine. And then you have maybe some folks in the Middle East not pumping as much oil as we might like them to. And then Europe decided, well, we don't want to frack here. We want you to do that over there. And then we stopped here. And none of us want to see environmental damage done to the planet, but we also don't want to see dictators take over the planet or the economy come to a halt. What's a reasonable proposal for America
yeah.
and American sovereignty in terms of green and renewables and maybe pumping some oil?
So look, we were the first institutional investors in Tesla Motors. So I think I have enough bona fides to say this. I believe in green technology, okay? Absolutely 100%. But energy, and in the same fund we did Tesla, we actually had fracking assets. Because energy independence is
Oh, that's incredible, really?
Yes.
In the same fund?
In the same fund. Because then, as it is today, energy independence is a national security issue. This is not a partisan issue. Extremely important people understand this. Extremely important to understand this. It's not about Democrats, Republicans. It's about wars in the Middle East. And the reality is that the Saudis are not pumping. OPEC is not pumping. This is terrible for America, and they know it. They're squeezing their economy the way they did in the 70s. And it's absolutely being done on purpose. So the answer to that, in my mind, is twofold. One, we should have an we need industrial policy general in this country, but the first thing we should have is an energy policy. Energy policy should look like this. We take all of the background subsidies, literally make them equal, and we give, let's say, $500 billion total, $250 billion in low-cost loans to the energy patch for drilling in places like Texas, Louisiana, and an equal amount to green energy. And we sprint to a green future. At the same time, we ensure that this country is safe and we have energy security in this country for all the people out there being hurt by high inflation. It's a security problem.
And, what do you guys invest heavily in manufacturing. What do you see in terms of the future of manufacturing, the opportunity for onshoring manufacturing? Are there technologies that you guys are excited about that create an advantage for the United States to build manufacturing capacity to service industry here? And
yeah, look, I think this thing about we outsourced the entire our entire manufacturing base to China because it was cheaper. But the reality is that the productivity difference between the kind of U.S. and China right now is about 8-1. So a U.S. worker is 8 times more productive than a Chinese worker. We found in cases like Tesla where we actually helped
in terms of GDP per worker?
Yes.
Okay.
We helped to insource the supply chain of Tesla. Why is Tesla fully integrated? Because I got news for you. You actually can make stuff in America, and it's made
shocking.
Very well. Shocking. Okay?
Shocking.
And let me tell you, when you
why do we have this narrative that it can't be done, yeah. And then we go to okay. Gigafactory and you see
let me tell you
it
why,
having
man.
Been done?
Let me tell you why. And boy, I mean, here's this. I'm probably going to get pilloried for saying this, but great companies are built by engineers like Elon Musk. That's a reality of it. And they know they want to control their manufacturing. We do it here so we can iterate faster and make the product better. If the product's good enough, you'll sell it for a great margin. They get optimized by marketing people and destroyed by the CFO. When you put the finance guy in charge and he's like, oh, hey, we can get a lower piece part by sending it to China, but he doesn't understand the iteration cycle of making that product, that guy destroys the company. And that's what happened in America.
Bean counters.
Yeah, we put the CFOs in charge. For God's sake, don't do that.
Fuck these bean counters.
I mean, can I say that?
Fuck
well,
them.
No,
let me say that.
More engineers.
Let me say that. If you calculate return on invested capital and you think about this carefully, what happens is these long supply chains to Asia, they have huge capital deployed. But if capital is cheap, you do that because the piece part price is cheaper. But if you calculate what happened at Tesla in particular, when you calculate the overall cost and capital wasn't free because we didn't get any, it was actually much smarter to bring it back.
Right. So the long-term cycle, you make more money. The short-term cycle, you make less money. The short-term cycle, you make more money. I mean, is that another way to think about it?
Like,
for short-term outcomes.
You improve the income statement because you might improve profitability in the short term, but you actually hurt the balance sheet because you send all this capital on the water over to China and you're never bringing it back. And your iteration cycle goes down
right. Because
you've got...
So what you're saying is the product's less innovative.
For sure.
It is, but he's saying something really important, which is that it's the financialization of the P&L that in some ways led to the decline of American manufacturing, in part. Meaning, if you're a CEO of a business and you construct your employment agreement and it's based on a certain kind of earnings in a certain period, a certain earnings per share, the incentive to then drive financialization goes up. Now, the perfect example of this is if you compare it, for example, and you did this, the comp package that you gave Elon in 2018 versus the comp package that any other CEO in America got, it was completely black and white. It was opposite land.
Yes.
And you basically completely said, you get nothing now. Let's set these extreme goals. And then if you can hit it, you'll get compensated. So much so that, you know, when you had Glass Lewis and ISS.
They all said no, right?
The ISS Glass Lewis said no, but they said most things. And we're being sued for it, so I've got to be careful what I say about it. But we had a comp package fully voiced on equity appreciation
right. That
required creation of new products. And look, I'll pick on Apple here. Apple's the first stock I ever bought. I was 12 years old. My mom actually went to Oakham Bank and bought me a few shares of Apple. I still have it in my account to remind me what it takes to build a company. Steve Jobs dies. Terrible. And look, then, you know, Tim Cook takes over. Tim Cook's a supply chain guy. I mean, they've really optimized profitability. It's unbelievable, $2 trillion market cap or something now. But man, when's the last time they made a new product?
AirPods. Yeah.
I mean,
Great product, but it's not an end change tomorrow.
iPhone.
Incredible free cash flow.
Yeah.
And they aggressively buy back their stock.
Yes, it's
And
great,
the financialization of that company has attracted. I mean, like, if you look at the largest shareholder, is the most sophisticated financial asset owner in the world, Berkshire.
Yes.
Berkshire doesn't buy technology companies. They buy incredibly well-run financial assets.
And it is.
By the way, look at how Zuck's getting lambasted for the VR investment. Some might say that strategically it's not a great investment, but he's saying, fuck it, I'm going to spend $10 billion a year.
No. He said it for a quarter, and then he had to take it back and cancel it.
Oh, he said that they took it back.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what he wanted to do.
And so to your point, like, it's very hard to really build things now.
Yes, but it can be done. And look, I think one of the... what is happening in the world today, geopolitically, is tragic. The war we are experiencing in Ukraine is absolutely tragic. But from all tragedies come some good things. There's always a silver lining. And one of the silver linings here, I think, should be the acceleration of reshoring of all these products into America to rebuild our industrial base, because we actually can do it. I can tell you, I started my career basically as a factory manager in California. It can be done. There are Americans who want to make stuff between here, Mexico, Canada. We can make pharma. We can make high-tech products. Yes, the price might be a little higher, but I got to tell you, the iteration loop would be better, and your value would be better if the product is better. People will pay for it.
And resiliency.
And resilient. Listen, for 100%. 100%.
All right. We are setting up a couple of microphones here. Antonio has been gracious enough to join us for some Q&A. The audience is filled with entrepreneurs, capital allocators, artists, and builders. So we're going to put a couple of microphones out there. Hopefully some lights on the microphones if I can see them. Line up and remember the rule. We don't need to know about your company. Just a tight, concise question. Anybody does any marketing or promotion, we're all going to groan. Let's practice a groan. 3, 2, groan. No guard. You can say your name. You can say your favorite.
Wait, before we start.
Yeah.
Is Chris Malloy here? Okay. Everybody, you guys may want to just know Chris. Whenever you're in Vegas, Chris is the guy at Carbone in Las Vegas, which is the most... You know,
hardest
restaurant reservation to get. But Chris bought a bottle of wine for us that we can open now and drink while we do the AMA. Yeah.
Oh, well, bring up a bottle of wine.
Anyways, that's Chris Malloy. Say hi to him. Get his number and text him if you're ever in Las Vegas and want to go there.
I mean, only Chamath would bring the captain of Carbone to our event.
Oh, quick to drink? Let's drink some wine.
Yeah, let's do it.
That's fantastic.
Ah, nice to meet you. All right, first question. Tell us your favorite bestie, and then...
We're still doing favorite besties, right?
Favorite bestie, and then tight question. Go.
All right, favorite bestie, Jay Cal, point guard of the century to this team, so hats off to you. So my question is, first of all, we've been here all week, in the last 3 days, watching these cards fall from the sky.
Yeah.
And we all know that you guys center around this poker table, this beautiful game. My question is, how has that game influenced both your relationships and decision-making in business and your personal lives?
Great question. Chamath, start us off, and you can go to the back, and next person, queue up.
How has poker influenced?
Our friendship, our lives. How has the poker game itself had an impact on our lives?
Okay, I think I really do believe this, but I think it's the most incredible game and training ground for business, because... in any given moment, you are forced to deal with the spectrum of good information to moderate information to bad information, good outcomes, moderate outcomes, bad outcomes. You're taking risk. You're learning information. You're adjusting your style. And the most important thing is you're forced to anchor to your core values or not. How you behave at the table is how you behave in life. You know, you can take
these
wins poorly.
That's not good news for Phil Hellmuth.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You can take these wins poorly. You can take these wins well. You can take the losses poorly. You can take the losses well. I would encourage all of you to learn to play the game with your friends. It's a beautiful, beautiful
game. And start a weekly game. Sachs?
Well, the poker game at Chamath's house is how I got to be friends with Chamath, right? I mean...
Yes.
I'm just saying, this is what you guys tell your wives while you stay up all night playing poker, because I've been there with you guys.
Yeah.
It's pretty freaking degenerate.
Yeah. We're all holding hands.
Exactly.
Talking about
baby, it's training. Yeah. It's training for business. No, it is training for business. I'm kidding you, but I've been there.
I've been there.
I've seen the drinking and the food, too. It is training for business.
We're not degenerates, but that's actually...
I was just saying, Chamath, I mean, didn't you invest in Yammer after I started playing in your... weekly poker game?
Yeah, and it was actually so degenerate. What really happened after that was I was in Las Vegas in 2011. I had just left Facebook. I moved to Vegas. And I was on the phone with Sachs in between playing tournaments. And he, like, let me in, invest in Yammer. Literally, like, and, you know, you did me an incredible solid because I put money in. And you know what this is like. 9 months later, he sells to Microsoft and I returned a third of my first fund.
Ooh, yum, yum.
And it really solidified my reputation. So, I mean, I owe you a big one for that.
Well, but anyway,
I got a story about this, though. So yeah, David Sachs, I've known David for 25 years. He did Yammer. I want to put money in. He said no, because if...
This is a true story.
This is a true story. He said no. He said no because if this fails, you are my backup plan.
Oh, for a job?
Yes.
Well, he didn't offer me a, job.
I wanted David to come join me.
I was so afraid of losing everyone's money when I founded a company, you know?
He literally took a little check from me.
I wanted to have like one friend whose money I didn't lose. But, you know, that was a long way of thinking about it. We should have.
Freeberg? I mean, how is the game?
Well, before Chamath, are you leaving?
No, I'm grading glasses.
Wait, come back for a sec.
Okay, he'll get glasses. Okay.
He's getting one.
I'll tell you guys one thing. Chamath is one of the most generous people you will ever meet.
Unbelievable.
He is unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
And for all of his bluster about his friggin' mink coats and shit, like
chinchilla.
He has brought together a group, and he largely is the reason that I think the game grows and goes on. And you saw some of the amazing people that we've had on stage here. Some of our friends are here that we play in our game with. That really, that network has been built and solidified because of Chamath and his generosity and friendship. It's really something I've learned to appreciate in my life. And you know,
thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tremendous group, and
amazing people. Like
amazing people. The consistency of it has been amazing.
And it's a degenerate group.
Chamath had this like little tiny $2 million house with like a 1.5 car garage when he was at Facebook, and we would play in the garage. That little tiny place you had, remember?
Yeah.
You know, before you bought the two houses next door and knocked them down and you know, gentrified. But true story, Sachs said, hey, you know, you're doing these conferences, you should invest in the companies. And this is when I put the fix in for him to win TechCrunch 50 at Yammer with Yammer. He said, I have to win. And then his wife told my wife he has to win. So then I basically got the whole jury to vote for him with Yammer. He wins. And he goes, hey, schmuck.
All of my success is due to J-Cal. You guys understand that, right?
It was a good fix. I put the fix in for him. But he said, listen, I want to thank you for this. And you should start a fund. Instead of doing all this work at the conference, why don't you just invest in the companies? I'll put $250K into your fund. I'll be the anchor. I said, that's incredible, really? And he said, yeah. And then I went to the poker table. I told the story. And then Dave Goldberg, rest in peace, one of our great friends, and certainly the best amongst us. Thank you. He said, I'll put money in too.
Great, thank you.
And he put money in. And then Billy said, I'll put money in. And everybody said they put money in. Freeberg said, I'll take a pass.
Which was it?
But, you know, we'll put that aside. Anyway.
I was all locked up in other stuff.
Yeah. He's like, I got a quinoa farm I've got to take care of.
Cheers.
Okay, all right.
Cheers.
Fellowship. And this is a true story. Bill Lee's there. He couldn't make it to here, but he's one of our great friends and one of Elon's best friends in the world. And he said, of course I'm in. Would you mind if I tell our billionaire friend, the co-founder of eBay, Jeff Skoll? And he tells him, Jake Howe's doing a fund, you should do it. I meet Jeff Skoll's money manager and Jan, and I say, hey, here's what I'm doing. I'm a first-time fund manager. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I'm a former journalist. And he said, how much is the fund? I said, $10 million. He said, I'll take half. And I said, I'm sorry. And he said, I'll take $5 million. And that was the biggest check I ever got, and it was because of Billy. And literally that first fund was raised around the poker table in one night. And that changed the trajectory of my career. And that really is the fellowship. And it started with David and you hosting. And I remember it was like yesterday. And I think maybe also a good moment to just maybe cheers to Goldie. Dave Goldberg.
Yeah.
No longer with us. And Tony Shea, cheers, who played in the game as well. Two incredible men.
Next question.
Hey, my name is Bobbin. Favorite bestie is Chamath. Great to
thank
meet you,
Bobbin,
last night.
By the way, Antonio is also our people too.
So he's the bestie. All right, listen. We know Chamath's your bestie. Quick with the question. Let's go.
Yeah, my main question is like when you guys actually decided to manage capital for people. Like, what really was the scariest step in taking that leap and taking that risk? I know a lot of you are GPs, solo GPs, so.
I mean,
Zach, you made a big leap.
was the scariest step? Well, I mean, even as a founder, like I mentioned before, I was like so worried about losing people's money. I mean, that was like, I mean, I don't know if like founders today even care that much that this seems, but it just seems like, oh, company didn't work, move on to the next one. I mean, maybe that'll change now that the environment's not going to be as free flowing, but I was always like really worried I was going to lose people's money.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was something that sort of kept me up at
night. I remember when I started Social Capital, I think I was playing. I was either playing golf or I had dinner with Chase Coleman in New York. And Chase says to me, I'll tell you the one piece of advice Julian gave me when I started Tiger Global. I said, what was that? This is 2011. He said, this is a death sentence. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And he said, you are the only person that's going to live with this because you're responsible, especially based on who your LPs are, for folks that if you really think about who they are, it's just going to create this thing there. And it's like, you know, and I was lucky in that moment because we were able to get like the Knight Foundation and Mayo Clinic and these folks that are doing these good works, but then you're representing their capital.
It's heavy.
It's heavy because you make this decision.
Yeah.
And if it's wrong, you just feel literally like you're derelict and you're taking money away from sick children or, you know, free speech. I mean, that's a brutally stressful thing to lose money on behalf of people.
By the way, I'll recommend as a founder, if you raise money from your friends too. You know, and it'll really change how you operate.
Yeah, I mean, I raised the first fund from my friends, and I tell you, I took every single deal very seriously, and I did my diligence, and I was very thoughtful about it. How about you, Antonio?
Oh, man, our first fund, there are two fears I had. The first one was raised from, I live in Chicago, from my friends in Chicago, and I literally said to one of my partners at the time, if this doesn't work, I have to move. I'll have to really do Chicago. Because in Chicago, you might get killed if you find Silicon Valley. This is not like...
I thought you were meaning the weather.
No. I mean, these guys lose your money.
He was talking witness protection.
Yeah, exactly. These guys lose your money. People kind of like, cool. Oh, I'm sad about it. In Chicago, like, break your legs. They burn your house down, man. It's a whole different
thing. All right, let's take another question.
Sorry.
No, keep going.
No, the second thing, I mean, honestly, the worst thing for me, the most scary thing for me was just the people. I had three or four guys that had worked with building companies before that, and I knew that I just felt if I disappointed them, if we failed, I would have felt terrible.
Yeah. It certainly makes you focus on the game. It's like being staked in poker. You play better. Sir.
I have a question for the 17th most important person from PayPal.
I'm just kidding. Ooh, David.
Obviously, Friedberg is my favorite bestie.
Okay, all right, science boy. Let's go. Let's go, nerd. Unbelievable, the Friedberg love. All right, Friedberg, soak it in.
You've been talking about how all this increased money supply has been sending the asset prices up and now it's unwinding. I don't think we've heard you talk about crypto specifically. Bitcoin has obviously come down, but it's still over three times where it was pre-pandemic. Curious what you think will happen in that world as this unwinds.
You want me to address that?
Sure.
It was for you. 17th okay. Most important guy.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing about the crypto market to understand is that it's like a liquidity sponge. The more liquidity there is out there, the more people feel empowered to make speculative investments, and crypto is like the most speculative. Now, that's not to say, you know, it's not real. I actually do believe in Bitcoin. I think there'll be a number of other sort of alt currencies that work. But probably the vast majority will not, and there's been a tremendous amount of speculation and inflation there, and so that space is in the process of correcting. You know, I've never been able to say like what the right price levels for any of this stuff are. Let's say you believe in Bitcoin long term. Let's say you believe it's going to be the first non-fiat currency. What price should that be today? You know, there's no like discounted cash flow analysis you can apply to it. So it's always been very hard to know what the prices of these things should be. And so in practice, the price is a function of how much liquidity is in the system. And when you go through a period of liquidity getting destroyed, it's no surprise that crypto
goes
first with it.
Yeah. Antonio, have you touched, I mean, you were so into physical assets and building real things like spaceships and rocket ships. When you watch this crypto bubble, you know, grow and burst and grow and burst, and now it's burst again, what's your take?
Well, first I want to tell you, I bought my first crypto, I think in 2017, because David Sachs and Bill Lee were pushing the Ponzi scheme on me. So they were like, I was at a birthday party. I think you were there too, Jay Callen. They were like, they were hawking Bitcoin. So I bought some.
Nobody had heard of it at that point.
I know, I bought some. I think it was like Bitcoin. $800 of Bitcoin. So here's my general view. I think that Bitcoin in particular is a bet on rising political risk and on political freedom. economic freedom is closely linked to political freedom. And last time I looked, Ukrainians are the third largest holders of Bitcoin. And if I were sitting in Taiwan today, I would have 10-15% of my assets in Bitcoin. So this removes the ability to control currency, capital controls from governments. I think this is very important, and it should survive. Price levels, I don't know. I do have a reasonable amount of Bitcoin as a hedge to political risk globally, and that's how we think about it. We have invested in infrastructure assets in and around a blockchain. With Dave, we have a couple assets because we believe that blockchain itself is a platform shift in the technology of tracking assets. This is a real thing, and it's going to happen. It's going to change the way we do finance. So we invest in infrastructure.
Got it. Let's take another question. Ted is right.
Mic over there.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to take one from here. We'll alternate. So Tide is right.
Yeah. Hi. Carl Muntra, CEO of Credo. I have to say I'm a science nerd, Friedberg. But J-Cal, it's been awesome today. I want to say, you guys, like, your courage and bravery to do what you've done with the pod and watching this today, like, thank you.
Question.
Thank you. Yeah, you've talked a lot about later stage. I'm wondering if you could like tune in a little bit more on pre-seed and seed and kind of what you're seeing in terms of valuations and metrics that you've got to hit in the earlier stages.
It's very simple. You know, I invested in Uber, Thumbtack, and Calm for $15 million combined. That was their combined valuation.
Post money.
And those all three companies had products in the market. And then what we saw over the last 5 years is people wanting credit for a white paper, a prototype, an MVP to the tune of $15 to $50 million. And we did sit out some of those and said, listen, when the product is ready, let's take a look at the product and talk to the first two or three customers. To David's point, about 0 to 1 customers is the really hard hurdle. And now it's back down to 6 to 15 million for a company that has a product in market and maybe 50 to 100 times yearly revenue for evaluation. So to the extent you can get to 200K in yearly revenue, you can get, you know, a $10 to $20 million valuation. So I'd say halfway back to normal and perhaps a permanent, livable reset, because the outcomes have been pretty fantastic. So the early stage should go up. The only thing you really need to raise money is to build a world-class product and just get a couple of customers who are absolutely blown away by what you've built. That's all you need. But everybody gets concerned with the theatrics and the performative stuff and their network and nonsense and who you are and where you came from. None of it matters. Build a world-class product that two or three people are obsessed with, and you'll get the seed check. Focus.
Yeah, I think Brad Gerstner had... sorry to interrupt your applause, J-Cal. I know that's important to you.
I'll take what little I can get.
So I think Brad Gerstner made a really important point on this, which is the new normal is going to look like the old normal, meaning the pre-COVID normal. We had the abnormal period was this 2-year COVID period where 10 trillion of liquidity is pumped into the system. Things are going back to what they looked like before all of that happened, and maybe before the Fed started with this zero interest rate policy. So we're actually getting back to normal. Understand that the environment we're entering now is the normality. The abnormal period was the inflation we saw in assets over the past couple of years. That's the like reset that everyone's going to have to like wrap their heads around.
Sax, you're my boy.
Finally.
One for Sax.
I think there may be some preference falsification around this because people don't want to admit they're conservative. All the polling shows this. So, but anyway, thank you, sir.
And your second favorite bestie is Tucker. Go.
For early stage SaaS investors, which most of you are, in an increasingly digital world where there are large SaaS solutions for nearly everything, how do you think about selecting companies and founders in the early stage that are coming to market with a small amount of utility, and how do you think about they compete with companies with already established customer distribution?
Yeah, so I think one of the things I really like about SaaS, which is software as a service, basically B2B software, it's business software, okay, that's sold as a subscription, is that the world's never going to run out of new ideas for business software. Business keeps changing, so therefore the software that businesses need will keep changing, and there will always be an opportunity there for new companies, new verticals, new niches, there'll always be new ideas. And so I'm never worried about running out. In terms of how we evaluate the actual idea, we've actually been super transparent around the metrics that we need to see. It really does start with a company hitting the metrics hurdle that we need to see for example, Series A. You're roughly more or less $1 million of ARR. You want to be growing 15% month over month, certain net dollar retention, certain capital efficiency. We've published it, on our website and our blog. So it starts with that. And then once we know that, like, our thresholds have been hit, then we get into more qualitative or subjective factors like, what do we think about this founder in this market? But one thing I like about it is just it's very well defined, like what we're looking for. And so, just go to our blog, you'll see. We'll tell you exactly. There's no mystery
outside
to
it. Outside of productivity tools, though, there's not a single company that can stay in one category and become really big. What does that mean? There's not a single public company that doesn't have now an entire strategy that says we sell at SMB, mid-market, and enterprise. And so the thing for SaaS businesses, unless you're like a really powerful productivity tool, like a Slack or an Atlassian, your valuation capped in the mid to high single-digit billions as it currently stands today. That's just the law of the math in the public markets on how you're rewarded. How do you grow out of it? You have to embrace a strategy that actually does more, where you become a system of record. So a good example is like a Zendesk. They hit an upper bound. There are many of these examples. And so if you're building a SaaS business or you're investing in a SaaS business, the other thing to think about is, in the absence of being a productivity tool, of which, again, there are a few, everything else has to find a way of being applicable to larger bodies over time in order to maintain valuation.
We're going to try and move faster so we can get more people.
Another question here.
Hi there, guys. Favorite besties, probably four-way tie, but maybe Chamath edges out just a bit.
Okay. It's not a tie.
Tie goes to Chamath. Quick question. Tide is right.
So, you guys have done incredibly well. So what would you do if you're dropped in the middle of, say, Kansas, take away the resource, take away the network, and take you back to age 25? What would you do and why?
Antonio, take it.
I'm actually from Michigan. I got dropped in the middle of there with no resources and not a lot to do. And I wasn't 25, I was in my early 20s. I would find a way to make it work, man. You should actually, whatever scale you want to start at, whatever job you have, I would try and start a little company. There's always people, listen, a place like Grand Rapids, Michigan, man, you could cut grass. I had a little computer company when I was 12 years old doing like networking for people in the old days. I mean, there's always something you can do if you had a valuable skill. Build a skill, start a company, and just get started. Start moving. And make good decisions along the way. One good decision compounds on top of the other, and all four of these guys, what they have done in their careers is made very good decisions, and they've kept moving when they've had problems.
And you start early.
Yeah, you got to start early.
I
just want to tell you this. They may look like super successful guys now, and they are, but it wasn't easy, and it wasn't linear. They've all had ups and downs. They've all had problems.
They still do.
What they do, and I have great respect for all four of them. I know them all well. They keep making good decisions. They're highly resilient, and they just keep going. And I would tell you to do the same thing.
Yeah. You gotta
the only thing
going.
I'd add to that is to keep learning.
I'm getting some applause here, man.
Oh, yeah, here, go.
I haven't had any, man. I haven't had any. I just got here.
But I would just say keep learning as well. Yeah. Like, one of the biggest advantages I've had in my career is that I try to always learn as new stuff as often as I can. And whenever I find an area of interest, I pursue it in terms of deepening my understanding of it, and that's always created opportunities for me that I wouldn't have just stumbled across or walked my way into.
It's such a great opportunity to have you here, Antonio. When I asked you to do this, you had never been on a podcast before.
No. Have you never done this kind of thing?
I've never done this kind of thing. No.
It's awesome. Thanks.
I'm only doing it because it's the four of you, and I am usually very private, but I'm enjoying it.
You have an incredible voice.
It's like very NPR, it's very like public
great,
radio.
Yeah, it's like, hey, everybody, you're listening to the politics and culture. I'm Antonio Gracias.
People tell me I have a voice for radio and pornography. Yeah.
Wow.
It works pretty well.
Go.
Hey, guys, I'm Samantha. Favorite bestie is Friedberg. I run the factory automation team for a large semiconductor manufacturer in the United States. really unimpressed with the innovation in industrial automation, and so really interested to hear your thoughts on where you see the next disruptions in automation, and also maybe a question for Antonio, where do you see the disruptor specifically in how we get not only the technology but the economies of scale for these really capital-intensive businesses in the U.S.?
This is your guy to answer
this,
for sure. And by the way, you should talk about automation at I don't know if you want to, but
sure.
Tesla, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we know a lot of automation. One of my partners is like a genius engineer in this area, and you're particularly in the chip business, you said, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, TSMC basically took this idea of outsourcing manufacturing assets that Intel did with TSMC in the beginning, that created that business and moved most of our high technology and chips off and offshore into Taiwan. This is like a terrible idea. And as I said earlier, we need industrial policy in this country. I think we need industrial policy to bring chip manufacturing back. It's very important. And the problem you have in automation and chip manufacturing in particular is, you know, when you think about where all the great engineers go today, they're good at automation, they're not going there because they're competing with TSMC. So you have a couple of Intel fabs still in the U.S., but we have to have some I think actually it's going to require industrial policy to force people like Intel, AMD to want to bring stuff back into the U.S. and to really get great talent to want to do it.
Do you think there's opportunities outside of greenfield models to kind of reinvigorate and unlock the capacity that we have in some of our older manufacturing here in the U.S.?
Yes, I do. We at Tesla took over this Fremont factory was a former GM Toyota factory. And, you know, we retooled it. We had to do it because we didn't have any money and it was free basically. But if you took that approach and you got you got really great entrepreneurs to focus on this problem through an industrial policy, they need money to do it. I think you'd get great innovation. Look, NVIDIA is actually here in the U.S. This is the reality. This is a great chip company. And the fabs they use are spread all over the world. But if you gave NVIDIA a fab or two, who knows what happens if it was the right price. Yeah. Jensen's a great CEO.
Did you go to that side?
Favorite bestie, Jason, you keep the ship together. You're the glue that keeps it together. My name is Chris. My friend and I started All In Talk 9 months ago. Fan page for the
Thank
TikTok
you, Chair.
Account.
See you. Yeah.
It's really obviously.
I was at the outdoor mall near my house, and my dog attacked another dog. And the guy was like, "It's okay. I saw you on TikTok." I was like, "Dude, I'm not." So that was because of you.
But
thank
that
you.
Wasn't
I didn't
for
get
your
sued.
Channel. That was for his quinoa channel.
It wasn't your channel. That was.
So my question is, in the 2022 predictions episode, Chamath, you talk about all-in media idea and starting an all-in media channel, maybe. And I wonder if you guys have talked about that anymore, your goals for the future on that, because I'm pretty sure everyone would agree here that if you did start one, it would do a whole of a lot better than CNN Plus. So.
Well, that may not be a very high bar.
Yeah,
but,
it's a very low bar.
I think it's
we actually did get together, the four of us. We sat in Freeburg's office.
What a shit show.
People started yelling. Two people walked out. Sachs just started to do this at the table.
Yeah. I'm definitely a good driver. My dad lets me drive in the driveway.
It wasn't a productive conversation.
It was completely unproductive. Look, it was completely unproductive.
That was our first and only meeting.
But we did take one key step, which is that Freeburg said, I'm going to get my team to draft the LLC agreement for the four of us.
Which we refused to sign.
No one signed it.
But it's
Nobody
in our
trust Freeburg.
But it's in our inbox, so we're one step closer to starting it. But joking aside, I still think that it'll become inevitable. And I think the reason is the two people, the robots, non-humans, that were uncomfortable with human interaction, David's... Once we do the recap of this, I think it'll be I think these two are probably the most shocked.
I'll tell you, by the way, my observation. I used to go to TED. I went to TED from 2008 till 2019. I stopped going to TED because I thought the content went to shit, and it basically got overtaken with like social justice talks and like used to start with like tech and interesting ideas about where the world's headed. And like I listened to our speakers this week, the last 2 days, and I'm like, man, like really fantastic content. I'm like, this could be the new TED. So I got really invigorated by that. Like I really thought, I felt like that was really necessary. And by the way, I think it's conversations people don't really seem to want to have, right? Like, and those are what make them really important.
And let's just say you are not the earliest believer in this was going to get pulled off.
Tell you how many times I've considered quitting the pod and not even showing up for this event. And I give Jason props publicly for doing a great job pulling this thing off. So,
go.
Hey guys, my name is Sarah, and I really love all of you. You got me through a very tough, challenging time when I started listening to you. I came here over a 16-hour flight from Abu Dhabi. So thank you.
Wow, that's a long flight. We love you. We love you.
I have a comment and a question. The comment, and maybe David, I have a lot of relatives in Sweden, and when the Ukraine war started, this is very amiable, innovative, beautiful people. Haven't had a war over 150 years, and they were putting gas in their car and supplying cans of goods, and got really, really nervous about what's happening, and were watching closely to see what would be the next step, I think, if the U.S. did not step in. So there's a lot of reality out there for the U.S. to stay, I don't know, like the savior of the world in a certain way or another. Finnish people felt the same way, Moldovans. So this is a real big reality out in the Western European world, not just Eastern Europe. So that's on my comment, so thank you. For the question, and this comes from my husband. if you're sitting on excess liquidity right now and want to invest for a long term...
Sax is raising a fund.
Was that a transition from World War III to
investment advice, stock tips?
How to make money in the market?
We want to say
that is dynamic range right there.
Yeah. Well done. Well done.
You've gone from two poles.
You know, yeah. I mean, you know the ups and downs of my life. So yes, it is like that.
Why don't we just take the first part, because I think it'd be good. So on Ukraine, I thought it was important to have this debate today where we got both sides of the issue. And we got two people who are very passionate on both sides. And I tend to agree more with Glenn on it, but that doesn't mean I don't want to help Ukraine at all. I just think we have to keep a close eye on preventing this thing from escalating into World War III. Because the Russians have 6,000 nuclear weapons, and their military doctrine says they can use them if they feel that they're existentially threatened. And so, if our objective here is to help the Ukrainians expel the Russians from an invasion, that's one thing. But if our objective, if we have mission creep into destabilizing the Russian regime, into basically trying to take back Crimea, which they see as theirs, if we're trying to weaken them to the point where they're no longer a great power, we're really playing with fire there. So we have to be really careful about our objectives there and make sure that we don't let this thing spiral out of control.
Antonio, what do you have thoughts on Ukraine, and are we being too dovish or hawkish or doing it just right?
So I think we are, there's a lot more going on here than maybe meets the eye, and this question was about Sweden and Finland. And here's what I would say, because I want to focus on that if our friends in particularly Northwestern Europe should actually be arming themselves. And if they arm themselves, we won't have this problem. That's the reality of it. The reason Ukraine, that's the reality of it.
Obviously, they're learning their lesson now.
The time for sitting on the sidelines in Central Europe is over. If you care about your country, care about your children, care about your families, then you should arm yourselves. Period, full stop. An American will be here happy to sell you weapons. No problem, with or without NATO. I think that's true. The reason the Ukrainians are able to defend themselves is because they have actually been buying weapons, and they built their own weapons with the Turks. That the drones that are being used to destroy the Russian supply lines are not coming from America. They're coming from a joint venture with the Turks. This is the reality. So should we be drawn into a war in Central Europe? No, I think it could start World War III. Should we help these folks defend themselves? Yes, I should. And in your particular part of the world, yeah, for sure. Start buying some weapons.
One question over here. Yeah.
Tough to follow, but my name's Joanna. Favorite bestie, I think Friedberg. I think you do a good job of being heard and hearing others equally. So I think that's an important skill. I'm trying to work on it myself.
More Friedberg. Wow.
In terms of my question, it's a little more qualitative, but some of us were having an interesting discussion about first impressions last night. And I'm curious to think, one, in terms of your own first impressions, how has the way that you introduce yourself to others changed as you've grown, and what have you learned about that? And on the other end, what are some of the most notable first impressions others have made on you, and why have those stood out to you?
That's an interesting question.
Well, seeing as the only two of us have emotions, maybe we can...
Yeah, we can chop it up. Sure.
I'm going to go to the bathroom.
You won't find any emotions there.
Yeah. Turn the mic off, please, the quinoa. Yes. Oh, my God.
Oh, my Lord. Well, that Baba Ganoush goes right through you. Continue. Baba Ganoush.
I think that when I was younger... I was more insecure, so I had to wear what few labels I had on my sleeve and use them as a weapon before others could use their labels on me. Mm-hmm. I honestly felt that way. You know, and in Silicon Valley at the time, you know, it really, there is a very monocultural aspect of, you know, folks from a few schools, you know, folks having worked at a few companies. And I had neither. You know, I went to Waterloo, which is in Canada, and I worked at AOL. So I didn't go to Stanford, and I didn't work at Google or Yahoo. And there's a great lineage and of where, you know, the really credentialed, credible folks came from. And so you do what any insecure person does. You kind of throw what few things you have out there very quickly,
yeah.
You know, trying to one-up the person in front of you. Yeah. And that's calmed down a lot. So that's probably
the
biggest thing that's changed.
It has, and I think it's I have a similar observation. When I was taking that R train into Manhattan, I used to say to myself, Jason Calacanis, editor-in-chief. Jason Calacanis, millionaire. And I was like, literally had a 16-page photocopy magazine called Silicon Valley Reporter, and I was trying to convince myself that someday I would be somebody. And I think that narrative was important for me. And people, when I would give them the 16-page photocopy, I'd say, here's my magazine. They'd say, this is a photocopy. I'd say, no, it's a magazine. It's got a picture on the cover. Because for me, that was why it was a magazine. And it eventually became a very large magazine, in fact, of 300 pages. And today, thank you. So I think there is something about manifesting stuff and just, you know, believing that you're going to get there. But today, I define myself by... the things I love to do. So when people do ask me now, hey, what do? I say I'm a writer and I have a podcast and I angel invest. And I don't say it's the number one podcast or I'm one of the top angel investors all the time. I just think about what... I don't say that. And I don't say, you know, like it's, the, you know, the book is in 11 languages or whatever. I got $1 million advance. There's no ego about it. I just say writer... podcaster, angel. Okay, how did it go in there? Okay, David, you okay?
What sort of advance are you getting?
$1 million, he said. A million dollar advance.
I mean, the book's in 12 languages now, thank you. I'll sign it. If you have one, I'll sign it.
Next question. Next question.
Sometimes I think Jason's just pimping out all of us to fuel his media career.
Yeah. You think? Sometimes? You think?
Hey, David, all honesty. How has the deal flow gone since you got this podcast?
I think it's down 50%.
Perfect. That was the intent. That was the intent. More deal flow coming this way.
Down 50%.
Down 50%. That's since you went on Tucker. Go.
Hi. Today, the crypto world is focused on decentralization, speculation, and stores of value. Who here is excited about micropayments? And whoever is most excited, which industries do you think will be most impacted by the newfound ability to send payments in as little as 1/100th of a penny?
Go ahead. Oh, favorite bestie. They want
Sax, you want to take it?
Yeah, go ahead, Sax.
So, you know, this question of micropayments has come up all the way since, you know, back to when I was working on PayPal. And one of the problems with micropayments is, as the name suggests, the amounts are very, very small. So you have to do a lot of them to create enough volume for them to be meaningful. And so there is always sort of this market size problem. Now, for crypto, there may be more of an opportunity there because the way that the old credit card rails network works is there's like a 25-cent charge per transaction. And so like at PayPal, it just didn't make sense to facilitate micropayments because the cost of that transaction always exceeded the fee that we could get. So you're right that or I think what you're suggesting with your question is that there is sort of a crypto opportunity to do this in a different way, because you can basically do a costless instantaneous transfer using a blockchain-based currency. So I'm sure someone's going to do something interesting with that. And then the question is just, how, like, what does that aggregate into? Is it going to be big enough to be?
By the way, there's an interim step, which is also pretty obvious, at least to me, which is this idea that, you know, for example, like, if Stripe actually took the time to embrace one of these stablecoins, there's no reason why Stripe needs to actually run on interchange as well. Because, like, you can just basically swap that dollar in a ledger into USDC. Let's just pick that as an example, not Tether, not to tilt you. Run it on those rails for free and then basically transfer it back. And it's not obvious why people don't do it.
You need the gas cost to come down. So, you know, like, you're running a transaction on Ethereum or certainly Bitcoin is very expensive right now.
But other chains.
Yeah. You need like a chain like a Solana or something like that. Something that's like super cheap.
And the cognitive load of the transaction, just the person deciding do they want to pay a tenth of a penny, is sometimes greater than the actual value of the money, which then creates almost like friction to them wanting to read the article. Let's take another question.
Hi, my name is Kate, and my favorite bestie right now is Friedberg, who often plays devil's advocate and so forces a stepwise
running
conversation.
Away with it, Friedberg. Woo, Friedberg. My Lord. How many people did you pay off? Go ahead.
So we all admire your successes, but we've also been hearing from Mar, for instance, that we need to be comfortable with failure and we need to become resilient. So when you look back on your careers thus far, what have been the toughest moments, the moments when you've made a mistake that have taught you a lot?
I mean, I had two huge ones.
And Antonio must have some too, yeah.
You want
mistakes?
My mistakes?
That you learned the most from.
Man, my biggest mistakes in life have been about people. And I have, over the years, made errors in judging people and how honest they were and how good they were. And as I look back on that, it's because I have a weakness for ideas that are great. And sometimes those come with great people and sometimes they don't. The reality is there are some bad people out there who are acting really great and doing interesting things. And we have we've suffered from that. I mean, I know David and I were to deal together that suffered from that. And it happens. So I've learned a lot about that. I've gone deep into neuroscience. I actually have a woman who's got a PhD in the neuroscience of emotion from Caltech now on staff that helps us learn, as you said, always learning, about how to assess people and how to assess their emotional states. That's the most important thing I think we've updated in our process and in my own thinking.
So you loved the idea so much that you
ignored
the other data, that this person was not honorable, truthful.
Did you know it? No, I mean, so there are times when there are two kinds of errors here. One type of error is we just didn't see it because the person was so good at being bad. They are, you know, one of the things a neuroscientist taught us is that about 5% of the human population has a brain anomaly that makes them actual psychopaths, defined as the amygdala doesn't fire properly when they do something bad, guilt, fear, et cetera. And in our particular industry, it's probably more like 10%. So we raised our base rate forecast to 10%, and it's gotten better. But there's some people who are so good at it, you just can't see it. I mean, Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes, okay? Like, lots of smart people running that company. We didn't, but it wasn't obvious to them, obviously. And then there are moments earlier on when we had yellow flags we overrode because we were so emotionally committed to the idea that we had a business we did was in the dental space. It was Medicaid dental clinics for kids that were black and Hispanic. And I'm from that demographic, and I wanted to make that great. And the reality is we overrode yellow lights because we wanted to make it great, and we failed.
Jamath, you were going to add some of your failures.
I had two huge failures, but they were more personal moments of learning for me. One was, you know, we were in the midst of building a phone, and it didn't come to pass. And if I really think about what I thought the problem was, this was when I was at Facebook, what the problem then versus now, then, you know, I would have said, oh, Zuck and I had a huge kind of, you know, thing and blah, blah, blah. Now what I would have said is, you know, I didn't really understand my own limitations and what I was really asking of him and the board in that moment. And then the second is there were all these moments that were people decisions at Social Capital that ultimately manifested in sub-quality financial and investment decisions. And had I had it to do over again, I would not have ignored some of the red flags because I was so desirous to be in the game,
to, you know, be in it, that I probably, you know, look the other way a little bit on folks that, you know, I'll just give you the practical example. I remember in a $300 million fund, I put $25 or $30 million into Bitcoin at 50 bucks a coin. And when the thing went to like 150 or something, just the pressure to distribute was so high. And I had conviction, I had all of these things, I had all the voting control, I had everything to just say no. And I didn't have the courage to understand my role as a leader versus something, you know, my job as an investment partner. And so you learn, you know. You learn what you're good at, you learn where your strengths are, and you try to just get better, try to fix those weaknesses. I mean, at the end of the day, what we're both saying is the same thing, which is ultimately, it has nothing to do with anybody else. It still comes back to you and what your skill set is in your toolbox and whether you're upgrading your toolbox every day.
Friedberg, Sachs, any mistakes that you're able to access through your CPUs in your long-term storage?
Well, I think as you get older, you learn how to pick your battles better. And you just have to decide, like, what are the occasions that are really worth fighting for and which aren't, you know? And sometimes you just let it go, and others you have to fight. So, and just knowing when you should choose which path, I think, is really important.
When you were
and by
younger,
the way, the guy you really want behind you in a battle is this guy. So, phenomenal investor, back when I was on the founder side of the table. So,
good brawler.
Yeah, for sure. That's why I got him a samurai sword for his birthday.
He did, yes.
Yeah. What did you get him for his birthday?
A samurai sword.
The collection of samurai swords you saw in my apartment started with David Sachs' samurai sword.
Ah, very, yeah. Nice, very nice.
Thank you, David.
It's very sharp, too. Aren't your kids trying to play with it or something? It was not a toy.
Yes, no. Not a toy.
Friedberg, anything in that long-term storage tape drives of a...
I've made a lot of mistakes. It's really hard. I'm very hard on myself. When I was young, I always said, there's no limit. And I always believed that. And when I hit walls in my life, it was very very difficult because it totally countered what I felt was possible. I always thought everything was going to be a success. There's no way I'm going to let anything fucking fail. There's no way I'm going to let anything not work. My voice is cracking, not because I'm crying, because I'm losing my voice. So...
We well, know that's it's all not, we need. If you cry now, everybody's going to be pro-Friedberg.
Jesus, now everybody's, Friedberg's my favorite bestie.
Friedberg. It's all for the vote. It's all for the vote.
He actually does have emotions, yeah. See?
But I would say...
he's smart and kind.
Yeah.
And a vegan.
Yeah.
He's perfect.
The biggest mistake I made...
He's my dream boyfriend.
Maybe coming on the stage was the biggest mistake I've made.
Joining the pot.
Oh, man. But I think Antonio's point is right. You know, you just have to be willing to learn and evolve. It's, you know, I now know that my life isn't about everything I do has to work 100% of the time. And being so hard on myself caused a lot of, like, emotional challenges for me over time. But getting to this point where I can now be much more calculated and just move forward quickly and learn from it has been a big evolution for me. That's just a general statement. But,
yeah. Yeah, and I would...
Oh, sorry, Jason.
Well, no, it's okay. I just... I was thinking about it while these guys were being so candid, and I was immediately going to punt and go to the next question, but I thought that would be unfair. You know, I think two things. One, I think a lot of my decision-making early on was out of fear, fear of losing whatever I had gained up until that point. So although I was a risk-taker and I was being bold in one way, I was also throttling myself because I was just so scared that I would lose whatever gains I had. And it made me an imperfect manager of people, an imperfect person, maybe on edge a little too much, and maybe not picking my battles. To David's point, I saw everything as a battle because those wins were so important to me because they were so hard fought. And then I think later in my life, I realized I never actually thought about what I enjoyed. I just thought about winning to an extent that was not healthy. And then after Dave Goldberg died and Tony Hsieh died, I really took a self-assessment of what I enjoyed doing. And I mentioned this yesterday, you know, hanging out with these gentlemen and to Antonio's way of phrasing it, which is just beautiful, the fellowship. I thought, that's the joy, you know, my family, my kids, my wife, and this fellowship with my friends that I wanted to invest in. And I made a deliberate effort to be a better friend, a better parent, a better husband, And because of all the gains I got from that and the joy that I got from it. And I just thought a little bit, God, I do like those conversations. I do like writing the book. I do like throwing the events. I'm just going to do things I enjoy, which took me 30 years of my career to actually assess, what is it that I like? And maybe I should enjoy the journey a little bit more. So I think it's a great question. I appreciate it. Let's take one more. Thank you. Yeah. Enjoy the journey.
Hi, besties. My name's Arya. I was the third or fourth employee at DoorDash. And my question is regarding... Oh, sorry. My favorite bestie... Yeah, that was a joke, by the way. My favorite bestie is Chamath and Sachs, although it's honestly Sophie's choice. My question is regarding the positive impact that Silicon Valley could have on the political discourse and politics, which I know, you know, there's typically an aversion to in tech. You know, you all have done a fantastic job outlining what those problems are, as well as your guests. What I'm wondering is what a viable path forward looks like. You know, Chamath, you mentioned that people in D.C. pay close attention to the podcast. Sachs has recently endorsed Michael Schellenberger, which I really hope can save our home state. And I'm wondering, is the solution something akin to a third party, like what Andrew Yang is trying to do, or some new, I don't know, Silicon Valley techno party, or, you know, what does that look like? I'm curious.
Well, I don't think it's set up to actually have a third party structurally in America. So what you have to do, practically speaking, is field more centrist normal people on both sides, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. That's a practical thing that we can all do, and then we can all show up and vote for those people so that the majority voice is much clearer than it is today. Because right now, the fringes a little bit get to hijack the process. And so we take things that should be common sense, and we pervert them in a way that just makes no progress possible. I really do think that we have that impact. I'm not sure how much can be quantified, but when I spend time in D.C., I think it's true what I was told and what I've heard from people. It's basically required listening or viewing. It helps shape people's opinions. Doesn't mean they follow it, but I think it helps people think about things in a more normal way. I think what happened today is like a perfect example. Like the way that Glenn Greenwald and Antonio Garcia Martinez debate, like that's probably for some of you was really unsettling, maybe. Raise your hand if you were just like, you felt awkward. Honestly, just be honest with you. Okay, well, you shouldn't, because that's normal. My point is, it helps you make it seem more normal, because those guys were not saying to each other that you're worthless and you're not. They were just debating.
By the way, we went out for a beer after that.
Yeah, this is my point.
So the three of us, I was like, okay, we need to like go out and get a drink and cool down. So yeah,
I'm not chastising you for feeling that way. I'm just saying this is what the culture does to folks. It makes you even afraid to hear people debate things and still have respect for each other. The way that he and Palmer kind of dealt with that, that's incredible. The courage that Palmer had to say what he did, and then for him to be the first guy to walk out and then to own that, I think those are really important moments. And you have 700 more people capable of being that way because of what just happened. So
yeah.
I think it's a slow march, but I think we're writing a small dent in a small way.
20 years ago, every political show on TV was a debate format. Yeah. Like going all the way back to William F. Buckley versus Gore Vidal, Pat Buchanan versus Michael Kinsley on Crossfire. I mean, they were all debates. Now, like, none of them are debates. It's all just their own little echo chambers. I think it's one of the reasons why this pod is successful, is we actually can have debates and there is a divergence of views.
What do you think, Antonio?
Have you ever listened to this pod?
I was on one once, dancing in the background.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. Thank you, the dancing bear.
Yeah, he did dance behind
him.
He
did make an appearance.
I recorded an episode from his house.
Yeah.
When you look at politics, any interest there? Any behind the scenes work you've done? And how do you think about it? Just as we get into, as Gen Xers, boomers are going away. I mean, we're going to kind of inherit this, whether we like it or not.
Yes, I would say a couple of things. First, whenever you have times, if you look historically, I think it's important to contextualize this. When you have moments of large technological change, you always have political disruption because the means of communication have changed. The Gutenberg press, the tall ship, and you just go back and look. It always leads to a lot of disruption and often to war. And so the question of, are those of us who are technologists at the top of the system, do we have a responsibility to steward this technology responsibly? We absolutely do. I believe we do. And I think that has been forgotten. That's number one. Number two, I have been involved in campaigns. And it's interesting, right now what I'm doing is supporting any centrist candidate that I think is good on either side of the aisle. I'm a registered Democrat. I support Democrats for most of my life. But the reality is now all I care about is sensible people that I think are really good. And I'm engaging in micro-targeting efforts across the spectrum in primary races. I would encourage all of you and anyone up here who cares about the American political system to engage in the primaries. Because the primaries are what determines the quality of the candidates that actually are up for election. And they're actually decided by very few people.
Yeah.
Like, how many of us actually voted in a primary? Like, very few of you. Very few of you, okay? So rather than us just complain about the divisiveness of American politics, next time, please, go vote in a primary and go vote for the center's candidate.
By the way, did I hear a lot of support for Michael Schellenberger out there?
Let's have him on the pod, maybe.
Yeah.
Hi, favorite busty is Chamath. I heard you speak with Vinod Khosla at Hack the North at the University of Waterloo. So my question is, Mar talked about these like startup journey systems like Stanford or PayPal. Do you see, like, over the pandemic, do you see any like remote or distributed systems that have like appeared, or do you see any like building that are not just centered in one geographical location?
I'll be really honest. I'm not a huge believer in this whole decentralized work movement. I don't think any high quality work can get done on difficult problems. So I think that there are types of products and types of problems that can be solved in a remote way, certain forms of software for certain kinds of products. But for example, let's just say you're trying to engineer, you know, a pharma drug. I don't believe that unless you're sitting there collaborating, talking, debating, you can do that necessarily over a Zoom. If you're trying to build something physical, you know, we have a business that 3D prints rockets. Those guys can't do that by just, you know, zooming around and having a couple calls. That doesn't happen. So I think it's too premature to kind of say working together has no value. I also think there's a huge cultural divide that will get created in America between these companies that come together and the companies that don't. And I think that the ones that come together have a chance of having more empathy in the end, because there are moments where you can actually get to know the people you're working with every day. And I think that that gives you margin for error, because everybody sometimes is a little, you know, dealing with their own things in their lives, sometimes can be a little rude. So, and we all have tolerances. Those tolerances are higher when you spend time with people. And they're much, much lower when you're just in a Zoom. So I'm, you know, I'd love to believe that everybody's going to be Airbnb-ing in a castle and a tent in a fucking treehouse. But I'm just not sure that that's realistic to really solve the big problems that America has.
You believe in the work from home, Antonio? Or you have a strong feeling one way or the other?
I'm more on Chamath's camp than not, but I will say we have some great companies that are fully remote. We have a company called Coalition, example, in cybersecurity. It's fully remote, run by a wonderful CEO who's under the age of 35, and he's found a way to make it work. And I've learned a lot from him. And so I'm trying to be very open algorithm about this. And I think there are people who can make it work, people who can't make it work. I can't make it work. I want my people in the office. We invest in pharma. We invest in biotech, and we have some biotech companies that have made it work remotely, and some that insist on bringing back people back. If you're in a lab, obviously you have to be back. But I think there'll be a mixed environment. And I also think there's an interesting retooling going on in productivity. I think the productivity numbers in America that we're seeing today are wrong, because they're not capturing what's happening underneath the technology because of these remote environments. So I don't know yet. I think it's going to depend on the CEO and how good people are and the type of industry you're in.
Yeah, I'm keeping an open mind towards it. I know that for investing, it was so much more efficient. You know, people could do 20-minute Zooms instead of two-hour meetings.
No, but I mean, think of the problem that created. Look at the overhang when you could raise tens of billions of dollars over Zoom. That turned out to not be a good thing.
Well, but also if you're a capital allocator, being able to meet with three times as many people, you could find more companies.
But this is my point. So I talked to a friend
companies.
Of mine who raised billions of dollars over the last couple year cycle. And he said, I was able to raise $50 million checks in 30-minute meetings. Now I'm spending 5 hours for a $10 million check. And my reaction to him in the back of my mind was, that's probably how it should be.
Well, part of that's the liquidity
cycle. That makes the entire system a little bit healthier.
Yeah, I mean, we raised $1.7 billion fund during COVID, and it was like all done doing Zoom. We're raising new fund now, and I'm flying around the world taking meetings. But part of that is just because people are coming back to the office, and the liquidity cycle has gotten, is reversed on us now, right? So the denominator has gotten, it's gotten harder to get capital. But for sure, I think I agree with Chamath here. Like being able to allocate $10 billion in a venture fund in 2 years over Zoom, and think that's on just the metrics and not see people, I think that's a bad idea.
Yeah, I'm talking about 250K, 500K checks.
Okay.
Might be okay. Take another question here.
My name is Kenneth Brown III, and my favorite bestie is J-Cal. The charisma is legendary.
He's my favorite bestie too, by the way. Don't be offended.
And then my question is, what advice would you give to non-technical people trying to fit into the tech-oriented startup venture world? I'm an econ major, but this just seems exciting. Like, how do I become a part of it?
And Tony, you have thoughts?
And I think that the best way to do this is to find a company you think is great and get a job. That's the reality. I mean, I would associate myself with a business that I really respect, people respect. And if the job is in the mailroom, or the job is a janitor, whatever, just figure it out. Because what happens with high growth companies is they need good people. And you'll be surprised how much being the first person in and the last person to leave, if there's an office, and doing the work that people ask you to do with a smile and a great attitude, like those people, they move up fast. So I would just find a way in, man, wherever it is, however it is, make it happen and start moving up.
By the way, you're not non-technical. You're not yet technical. And I think that's the opportunity that sits in front of everyone, that you can become technical. I had a cousin who was a music major at UCLA, worked in music, and then he came back from COVID and he started learning how to program online, taught himself, spent 6 months in his parents' basement teaching himself how to retool his life, and got some contract jobs on Reddit and boards and other stuff, and he got this amazing full-time job offer a few weeks ago. And it was really amazing that I got to watch him transform himself and his life over the last year and a half just by taking that on himself, and he became technical. It wasn't that he had a non-technical degree. It's that he just wasn't yet technical. And I think everyone has that opportunity.
I'll tell you a great quick story. He's a minority guy, grew up in Houston, really wanted to work at Tesla, couldn't get a job. Finally got a job on the line. He was making 16, 20 bucks an hour. Worked there, did well, transferred. Ends up in the supply chain group, ends up working in battery supply chain, ends up basically being two layers between him and Elon. Gets into an MBA, goes there for a few years, works on the side, and he ended up raising a bunch of money to start a battery business recently. And this is an example of what he just said, which is, you know, there are these jobs available, and then it's just, you know, is your chutzpah and your hustle. And he's an example, but it's a very motivating example to me because it just shows it's so possible. You know, and there are phenomenal organizations that identify talent and will move you up really quickly.
And knowledge is literally free, and experience is up to you.
Yeah, the overriding, I think, advice you're getting here is that skills are acquirable. And my Lord, getting to 50, 60% proficiency on a skill, just given what's on YouTube or MIT OpenCourseWare or any number of websites, you can do it in a matter of weeks. And now, of course, going from 60, 70, 70 to 80, that might take months and then eventually years. But startups are looking for generalists. They're looking for people who can say, I need somebody who's going to do the accounting and figure out how to do an email merge and build a mailing list, and then I need somebody to help with recruiting. If you could just become 30, 40, 50% as, you know, good at each of those things at a startup, you know, before people get specialized, eventually you'll have 10 people doing recruiting. But in the beginning, it's one third of somebody's job.
By the
so
way,
I love startups for that.
The sign of a great culture of a company is how little the obvious labels matter once you're inside of it. And the best companies, like a Tesla, can become a $1 trillion market cap because they find the kid working on the line and then 4 years later is running the battery supply chain. How does that happen? It happens because you're looking at the quality of the individual and their potential. Where they went to school doesn't matter. Their gender doesn't matter. Their ethnicity doesn't matter. None of it matters because the people don't see it.
They see work ethic. They see
results.
Effort. Yeah,
they see
results.
Effort. They see integrity. So that's another litmus test for you is like in the companies, even if you're a CEO and if you're building, if every other day you're reminding everybody else of like where people need to have gone to school and where they should have been, that's a road to nowhere.
Let's give Antonio a big round of applause. Very nice.
Thank you. Thanks. 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 Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good to see you too. Thanks, man.
My brother. Thank you. I love you. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you, guys.
Over here.
Yeah. Sunny Lama.
No, we kept Antonio here for like 2 hours.
I know. I feel bad.
He's like,
I've
really
never been on a show before.
He's like an LP meeting. He's like, I don't
know. All right. We're going to just take 14 to 20 more questions. Go.
Sunny Lama here. Chamath's my favorite bestie.
Yeah. There you go. Huh?
Because of him,
a little dry spell, huh?
Because of him, I shop at Laura Piana only. So, thank you. So, I just got a question for Friedberg. I know that you wanted to talk about this yesterday, about this sort of consumer credit crisis on the horizon that you see as potentially like the next shoe to drop. So, I think you wanted to mention something yesterday about it, but because of time and stuff.
I don't have anything more to add than what I said on the pod. I'm not like, I don't think this is like a high certainty. I'm just concerned there's a lot of loans out there, a lot of buy now, pay later, a lot of stuff that has floating rates attached to it. If we're going to have a recession, we're going to see job loss, you're going to see these, and by the way, these auto loan portfolios have like crazy outperformed over the last few years. And now that a lot of those auto loans are floating rate, those asset values are inflated, people are losing jobs. You could see a bunch of these things start to create a bit of a cascading effect over the next couple of quarters, depending on how this all goes. So I'm not going to put my foot down on the ground and say, oh my God, consumer credit bubble, we're totally fucked. It's going to lead to the next great recession. But I do think it's going to be pretty kind of surprising. Buy now, pay later, I saw a stat, I don't know if you guys saw this week, on how a lot of the people that are going on buy now, pay later sites are actually maxed out on their credit cards. And so they're actually fully credited out, and then all the smart algorithms are like, oh yeah, you're a good credit risk. Like,
oops.
Here's $1,800 to buy a Peloton or whatever.
Lightning round, 5 questions and we're done.
Yeah.
One bestie will answer each question. Go.
Cool. David Friedberg, you're my favorite bestie. What problem do you most want to solve right now?
Oh, binary lifters, actually.
Edible quinoa. Wow.
Actually, I've been working on the...
So, look, I've spoken about this publicly. I think it's a big problem. I was going to talk about it in the talk that we scrapped, but I'll do it another time, which is really the opportunity for biomanufacturing as a way to replace a lot of traditional food systems, including all of ag, all of animal agriculture, and a lot of the systems that we use to basically make our food. It's a big infrastructure play, you know, a couple square miles, you know, using Elon's analogy, you could basically recreate all the food on Earth. You could distribute those systems. And so I think that it can be extremely carbon negative. It sucks carbon out of the atmosphere. It would create incredible jobs. It's an incredible infrastructure opportunity. It would return billions of acres of land back to kind of, you know, whatever form, natural form we want them to be. So that's an area that I'm spending a lot of time in and that I'm particularly excited about.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, number two.
Hi there. I'm Katie Croft. Nice to meet you all. Imagine a parallel timeline where I say you're all my favorite, because it's all true. So I'm curious, kind of an extension of the media question. Have you given much thought to forming a consortium or community with the All In podcast and kind of what further applications of that? Because if you think about the force multiplicity of like any number of these minds in the same room working towards the problems we've talked about, from education to onshoring energy, it could probably be pretty considerable, the impact there. Because we have such respect for what you guys do and how you're doing it and the discourse you're having that, you know, we're clearly all diehards here. So I'm just curious if you've thought about it. I'm kind of trying to inception you here.
JKL, you want to take that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is a shit ton of work, but I think it is, and we all have day jobs. You know, step one was to try to just see, and I told the besties, let's just see if we can each make getting to the pod each week a priority and a habit, and that took the first year or so. So now it is a habit. We all value doing this. It has had tremendous impact on our lives, personally and professionally. It's been very inspiring for each of us. So we had to lock into that first. Doing this, you know, was a ton of work, and we'll see if it's sustainable. And we have some other ideas. We wanted to do a college tour was the other thing we were considering, which would be like 3,000 seats or 4,000 seats, and just an episode of the pod in Q&A. So I think that could be the next card to fall. And then maybe hiring Tim Urban and Nate Silver and then having them build a media company to take on CNN. But, you know, we haven't really given it much thought, but you never know.
They were here totally randomly.
Yeah, right. They were here totally randomly. We're not recruiting or anything, but, you know, anything's possible.
Hi, besties again. I'm Rejoice. I run a talent marketplace for early entry workers. We use gamification to accelerate their upskilling.
Plugs, remember, just,
yes. The question is about the Great Resignation, which we believe is a half-told narrative. So how can small businesses, which are most sole proprietors, democratize their own labor supply and demand?
Wow. I think that's a very difficult problem to solve. I think, again, if as a supporter of capitalism, I think one of the biggest things that we don't get right is how money gets to the right problems. I've said this roughly before, but like money is really just a voting way of deciding what you think is important in the world. And that's why the accumulation of money as just a practical matter, forget moral or philosophical, is so important because you can vote what you want. The thing is that aggregation happens easily, distribution is terribly broken. And so the ability for folks to solve practical problems is very hard because the ROI isn't obvious. And getting money from capital pools like us to individuals and sole proprietors is a very broken problem. A, because the systems don't exist. B, because the laws don't allow it. And until that gets solved, I'm not exactly sure how a business who can actually like build for the future well or solve their supply forecasts or demand forecasts can actually get the capital you need, because the lubricant that allows you to solve that problem is money. Has always been, will always be. But getting it to those people is legally hard and it's organizationally impractical. I don't know if you saw the last spot. I mentioned this thing. We tried this thing called capital as a service. It doesn't get to the sole proprietor level, but it gets to like small 5 to 10 person companies. We would send $50,000, $100,000 checks. Here's how hard it is. The cost of getting a $50,000 check, we did this fishery in Indonesia. It cost us $125,000 to give them $50,000. We still did it because I just wanted to prove the point. They ended up tripling our money, so we barely kind of like broke even. But it just goes to show you how really complicated.
A lot of friction in the system. Yeah. Okay, fourth question, and then one more after that.
Hey, I'm Prem. As a Waterloo poker player, favorite bestie is Chamath. I'm very into next-gen manufacturing, but as a pre-seed investor, my concern is follow-on financing. How do we get more investors interested in investing in the physical world? Because at least in Canada, it seems like most investors only want to invest in software.
No, I think this is what I'm saying. I think there's a very broken part of the capitalism right now, which is that technology investors, by and large, and I don't mean to disparage anyone here, are not well-rooted in the principles of math and finance. And I think that that's a real problem, because in a moment like this, that is where you can actually make safe investments of capital. You can structure the money in so that you are capital protected. You have assets to back these things. And the reason why folks don't do it is they don't understand how to put together a model to demonstrate it. And then the person that is then receiving that information is unfortunately not as well instructed as they should be to understand how to make a decision from that. That's what we have today. So it's a little bit of a miseducation problem. And it's going to affect the non-sexy areas. Rockets will always get money, but like 3D manufacturing at scale may not. Because of this exact issue, because people don't know what ROIC means.
Sir, you have the final question.
Favorite bestie is Friedberg, and hate to end on a recession
what a
question.
Fucking Christ!
Yeah.
But I'm never asking that question again.
Why do you guys? Why do you guys think it upsets you so much? Like,
well, because you're the biggest pain in the ass.
You
the
are the
thread.
Most fucking neurotic person.
Every time we post an episode, Ever. We should cancel the episode. We fucked everything up again. Why do we keep screwing up? We're going to destroy the pod.
I read the first nine comments and the downvote rate.
I was on YouTube.
Was 14%.
Somebody sent the volume.
We'll keep going, but go ahead.
The amount of noise we deal with from this one
They're not
going to
stop.
It's like literally
he
his
does,
inner monologue.
You should
monologue.
Not reward him.
It's like his inner monologue
you are feeding
is crazy.
A beast. You know if you had a two-year-old child who you've given too much candy to is
Bill,
kicking
can you,
and
can
screaming.
Can you shut him up, please?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
This is
all right,
what you're
final
doing.
Question.
If one guy
go,
can
go,
shut
go.
Your mouth up, it's Phil Deutsch, everyone. Yeah. Yeah.
All see right, so it seems like a common theme on the stage these last couple of days is you all feel like we're in a recession or heading towards a recession. But I get a feeling that you have the confidence that this is going to be a quick recession, like a year. So my question would be, why do you feel after 13 years of market manipulation by the Fed that it's going to be cured in under a year?
No, I think you're right. The average recession as measured, like if you look back historically, is 2 quarters. The problem is that we've never really figured out what it's going to take with the distortion of money that never should have been in the system. Because if you think of a supply-demand imbalance as being a naturally self-balancing phenomenon, if you perturb one side of it by an enormous amount, exactly to your point, I think the open question that the world has right now is that really a two-quarter problem? Well, the Fed has told you that they're going to take 3 years to get $3 trillion. You've heard from David that $10 trillion was put in. Probably another $3 or $4 trillion was productively used. But that still leaves another $3 trillion of sloshing around money that we don't know. So I think it's an open question. I don't know what you guys think.
Friedberg, how many months? How many quarters? Sachs, how many quarters, if you had to guess?
I just hate this definition of recession where it's about GDP decline when we had a lot of the underlyings in those numbers for GDP that I feel were like artificially inflated for a couple of quarters because of a bunch of the structural stuff we've talked about. So I don't know, like if you look deeper at economic growth, companies signing up more customers, sell, like a lot of technology companies are about increasing productivity with their tools, with what they're selling. And those businesses are going to continue to do well and to grow and to increase customers, increase revenue. And I don't think that there's necessarily a lot of the structural stuff that we saw with the GFC. The one thing I am concerned about, which I've highlighted, is this consumer credit risk. And besides that, it seems like, you know, things are, on good footing. So I don't know, like the technical recession definition, probably a couple of quarters. Yeah.
You never know, and I think the best way to look at the future is by doing scenario planning. So we could say this could be a short, medium, or long recession. Short would be 6 months, medium might be 18 months, and long might be 2 years plus. And we just say, say one third probability, and that kind of gives you some picture.
13 to 14 months.
Exactly. So. Now, what we're telling our portfolio companies is you want to have 2.5 years of runway right now because you got to go raise 6 months before you run out of cash, and you really want to have 2 years of cushion because things could be choppy for 2 years. I'm not saying they're going to be, but they could be. You don't want your company to run out of money and die just because of macroeconomic conditions that are no fault of your own. So if you can try to engineer that amount of runway, that's better. I also think that here's the thing about a quick recession is, or the prospect for one, we don't know what other shoes are going to drop. Yeah, consumer credit is still a shoe that we don't know if it's going to drop. Look, 6 months ago, did we think we'd be talking about Tiger Global or SoftBank, for that matter, potentially teetering on the verge of being redempted out of business?
Or Coinbase and Peloton just so things withering can change, to
right.
nothing.
Things can change fast. We don't know what systemic risk is in the system that hasn't been flushed out yet. And we won't be out of this until it feels like everything's been flushed out and then the market's back and things are sort of on an upward trajectory again. Clearly, we're not there yet.
Real estate and crypto doesn't feel like that's rushed out yet either. So,
do we have a clip to play as an outro?
I don't know. Was this the clip of the cut clip?
Before we go, can we please say thanks to the, team that works here?
Yeah.
And the team, Jason, your team at All In.
Yeah, incredible team.
Thanks to everybody, all of you guys that work
so
hard.
They really put a lot of effort into this. Pretty incredible. I guess this is a lost clip of us from last week.
You did not have like Dungeons & Dragons sleepovers in grade 7 and grade 8?
I was actually programming Pascal, and we made a water moisturizer, and it was a binary lifter, much like the ones you have on Tatooine. We had made a complete replica of Uncle Owen's water vaporizers on Tatooine, and that took 6 years, but it was great. And then I went, hilariously, as C-3PO. I went as C-3PO to our science fair. You should have seen the look on our teachers' faces.
Okay, you guys have your cold open. Let's go.
Let your winners ride.
Rain Man David Satt.